If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to the Karma You podcast. This is your host, Chloe Brotheridge. I am a coach, a hypnotherapist, and I'm the author of The Anxiety Solution and Brave New Girl. Thank you so much for listening today. I have an amazing guest this week, Shona Virtue. Shona is known for being a fitness instructor and yoga teacher, but for some reason this conversation isn't actually that much about fitness. We get into such a varied number of topics. She has had her career so far in the fitness industry, but she is now studying psychology, and so this is a real passion of hers. So we get into topics like her experience of therapy, why it's totally okay to have therapy, and we talk about things like how to find a therapist. We talk about something called attachment theory, and you might have heard this before. You know, some of us might be anxiously attached, for example, and it has to do with things that happened in our childhood. And we really get into why there's nothing to be ashamed about if you're somebody that is perhaps needy or codependent in relationships, because it's not your fault and it can often go back to these things in childhood. So we chat about that. We get into the pressures and boundaries of social media. And I also ask her my favourite question to ask people, which is, how are you really? And I love Shona's answer to this. She's really honest and open and talks about something that I think a lot of us can relate to, particularly at this time of year. So I think you're going to love this episode. I felt like I was chatting to an old friend when I met Shona, even though we just met, you know, 10 minutes before. And also I wanted to let you know that my confidence challenge is coming up on the 24th of February, 2020. You can sign up at karmayou.com/confidence. And it's going to be 5 days of community fun challenges, helping you to think differently and take some action so that you can take a few steps towards living the life that you want to live, being the person that you want to be, accepting and loving yourself more, building your own self-esteem, and just feeling better about being you overall. And last time I ran it was really, really amazing to see how people made profound changes over just 5 days and made new friends and expanded their idea of what's possible for them. So I'd love for you to join us as well. You need to sign up and register to get all the downloads and workbooks and access the community. You can do that on my website, karmayou.com/confidence. So let's get into the episode with Shona.
Welcome, Shona. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I am good. Thank you for having me.
I would love to know a bit about what it is that you do for people that don't know.
Okay.
And how you got to where you are today. Can you share a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll try and summarize. I have a tendency for anyone that does follow me or know me to kind of go on big tangents, but I'm going to do my best. You can always use the editing tool to cut this out, cut this down. So I'm a personal trainer and a yoga teacher. I have been for over 10 years now. Most of my business now is based on online. So I have a method called the Virtue Method, which is essentially a combination of strength training and mobility training. And that really comes from my background as a gymnast. And I found that the way to a healthy functioning and well-functioning, not just functioning, but well-functioning body was to really make sure that you were equal parts dedicated to strength and fitness as you were with like mobility and flexibility. And most people tend to do what they're good at. So you get lots of people that, you know, can touch their toes, but they're not very fit, or they can barely do a push-up. Or you get people that, you know, can run marathons and are super, super fit, but can barely even bend over to look at their toes, let alone touch them. And so that's one of those things that I'm like, if you really want a body that's going to be able to do the things that you love to do for longer, then you need to be dedicating equal time to those sorts of modalities.
And I can attest that your online program is amazing. And I love your integrity. And the way you do things has so much integrity, I think, to doing things properly and taking care. And there's so much out there that is not like that. And so it's so nice to have
thank you. I think that for me, and I know this is one of the questions you'll ask later, but fitness should really be this expression, or it is an expression of, and it's cheesy now, it's a cheesy term, but it should be an expression of self-love. I really believe that. And if not self-love, if that feels too far away from your mindset right now, if you're in a bad place, and I totally get that, then at least, at the very least, fitness should be an expression of self-respect. And if you are punishing yourself with fitness, then it's not an expression of self-respect. And I think that for too long, the fitness industry has really perpetuated this notion of punishment, no pain, no gain, you know, like sweat is fat crying, like all this sort of BS that just pisses me right off. It's like I'm trying to move us away from associating fitness with punishment.
Totally. I love that. And Yeah, not many people are saying that fitness should be about self-love. I think that is a really important message. And
it's because self-love is fucking hard.
Yeah.
It really is. Like, I find it really difficult. Trust me. Like, yeah. You know, I grew up as a gymnast. So for me, health and fitness, particularly fitness, has been something that has been in my life. So I see it as naturally fitting in my life as something like cleaning my teeth or having a shower. And that's what I'm trying to get people to do. But there are other aspects that are important in life that I am terrible at. You know, I'm a procrastinator in other areas. And procrastination, I often talk about, I think is really a form of self-harm, and it's a disrespect to yourself as well. So self-love is difficult. And some of us are better at doing different things that express self-love or that are an expression of self-love. And some of us just aren't. It's difficult. I think we're all on a journey.
Thank you for saying that, because I think it's so easy to think of self-love as bubble baths and just be kind to yourself.
Light
it's so
a candle.
Simple,
yeah,
you know. And actually acknowledging that it is a journey, it is hard work, and there are times when, you know, all of us will procrastinate, and that is kind of taking us in the opposite direction, but it's also very normal as well.
It's also very human. Yeah, exactly. So I think it's not, you know, the criticism around those sorts of things can often be more damaging than the actual act of procrastination. It's the guilt you have after it. I always call it like a guilt hangover, and it's so shitty. That's where all the shitty stuff happens too. You know what I mean? It's not just putting off paying a bill and then getting letters about, you know, the bill or whatever it might be that you're procrastinating in. It's the guilt that you have later where you're self-criticizing. And then what that leads to? That leads to the need to binge in the other direction. You know what I mean? Or perhaps it leads to whatever, numbing yourself from that guilt, which might look like alcohol, which might look like excessive use of social media, which might look like excessive sexual relationships, or think different things like that. We've gone deep too quick.
Yeah. We're gonna go deeper,
mate. Let's go back to fitness.
I wanted to go even deeper. Yeah. I'm gonna ask my very deep question that people love hearing the answer from people, and know that you can answer that you're doing really well or not doing well. All answers are okay and welcome. Mm-hmm. But the question is, how are you really?
Oh, when you sent me, so I have to tell you, so I'm telling everyone that listened, I asked Chloe to just send me like a basic kind of overview of what she wanted to ask. And this was the first question. And I honestly, it was like reading, it was like when you step into a warm bath or a warm shower and you're like, oh, it just felt so nice. Cause it was like, oh, you actually want to know. And and I felt seen. I know that's trendy to say, but it's like, I felt seen. And so that's a really beautiful thing, is asking how you are really. Because how are you is such an interesting question, in that most people are just hoping that you're just going to go, yeah, I'm all right, you know, or whatever, and keep it really light and easy. And it's just a quick question. So I never know how to answer that because I'm like, how deep do I go? So when you say, how am I really? I am really good, which I'm happy about. But as I was just saying off record, off microphone before, it's been a really interesting 2 years or so, I would say, where I've had to do a lot of unpacking around dysfunctional behavior in my life and how that has been a symptom of some deeper subconscious things that were going on for me. So I am good now. But if you'd asked me that question, I probably would have said I was good anyway because it just would have been too long to unpack all of it. But I think I can safely say that I feel good because I've been going to regular therapy and trying to work on these dysfunctional behavioral patterns in my life. So, yeah.
Amazing.
So deep.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Can I dig into that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. Just in terms of... I'm an open book. It's so fine. Probably too open, but let's go there. You can edit, like I said.
The unedited Shona of virtue.
Yes, raw.
What was your experience of therapy like? How did you choose a therapist? And how was your relationship with your therapist? Can you talk
Great
about
question.
That?
All right. So how did I choose a therapist? I'd actually had some really not so great experiences with therapists here in London. This is a therapist that I met in Sydney. And she was just actually her number was given to me by my mum. My mum was seeing her and then she had to stop seeing my mum when I decided to see her. I saw her because I'd had a breakup in a relationship that really was only for like 6 months, but it really hit me in a deep way and kind of uncovered all these behavioral issues that I was trying to get to the bottom of. And she was really amazing. I would say the relationship that I have with all therapists is very honest and open, and I think that's what it should be. I think when we try to filter our answers is where therapy becomes pointless. I mean, the whole point is being able to speak to someone so honestly and in a non-judgmental way that you can project every single subconscious experience and interpretation of your world onto that person. And essentially all they're doing is reflecting it back to you, but they provide you with the tools at which to handle those thoughts. Whereas when you speak to a friend or someone that's unqualified in that area, they have their own projections that they're going to project back to you, or they have their own life that isn't neutral. And so their opinions can sometimes warp yours. And we often attract people into our lives that we're having like experiences with. I think all of our relationships are mirrors. But when you speak to a trained professional and a qualified professional in that way, they will reflect back to you, but then they also provide you with a way to actually process that reflection and then learn from it and grow from it. So I guess my therapist has been able to, in a non-judgmental way, say, okay, these various behaviors that you are trying to change in your life are a cause of this thing that maybe happened in your childhood or this thing. So let's try and work through that. And it's so interesting because as soon as you uncover something, it kind of neutralizes a little bit. Doesn't always fix it because the real work happens in everyday life, happens outside of the therapy room, right? It's not like suddenly someone says to you, oh, that behavior is because of this. It's actually because, you know, the change doesn't happen there. You just become aware of it. And then when you go out into your everyday life, that's when you have to sort of make the changes, right? And so I think that for me, yeah, my relationship is, it's one of the most important relationships in my life. Absolutely. Yeah, and something that I think needs to be less taboo. That's why I'm talking about it. I think that, you know, when someone says to you, oh, I'm feeling a bit unhealthy, I'm going to go see a personal trainer, you know, you're like, oh, cool, that's great. Tell me what they tell you. And like, let's, you know, awesome. Like, let's work out together, whatever. When you say I'm not feeling so great, I'm going to go see a therapist, people are like, oh my God, is she okay? Is everything okay?
It must be really bad.
It must be really bad, yeah. Like, and it's like, no, not necessarily. If it is really bad, that's also okay. But if it's not really bad and you just decide that you're like, do you know what? I've never had any guidance or quote unquote personal training around my thoughts and how to process them and how to behave in society, in a society where we're taught to behave a certain way or where, you know, that doesn't align with what I believe or my values. It's like we're just kind of winging it. And I think that it's really important to have less taboo around speaking to someone about your thoughts. Ultimately, that's all it is. It's a personal trainer for my mental health. Literally. Why is it so fucking taboo?
Yeah.
I don't understand. So anyway.
And arguably, you know, your mind and your mental health is just as important as your physical health. And, you know, absolutely. Even more important maybe for some people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's silly because it's like, I don't know where it's come from. It's there's lots of reasons, but I think that you know, more and more we need to move away from the taboo of it. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, I've had so much therapy in my life and often talk about it and love hearing other people's experiences. It's so helpful for others to hear about, you know, how it is a good idea to get a recommendation from somebody. Yeah. And, you know, the relationship that you have with your therapist is so important. I think when they've done studies into different types of therapy, it's actually the relationship that you have with them that is the biggest indicator of the outcome rather than CBT versus counselling or
right.
something.
Right, interesting.
So
that makes sense.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you, I remember you writing about SAD a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share a bit about your experience of that and what effect that had on you and what changes you made?
Absolutely. Okay, so SAD, seasonal affective disorder. Well, sad, because it makes you sad. So I'm Australian, and I am also not just Caucasian. My mum is from Fiji, so I have brown skin, so it means I need a little bit more access to the sun in order to get the vitamin D I need or to process the vitamin D I need. And I just grew up in Australia. And so, you know, having sun in my life really makes a huge difference. So seasonal affective disorder is essentially when people are affected by mostly winter and the lack of sun that you get in that period of time. And it doesn't really happen in those countries that are around the equator. It's more so the ones that are further away that experience really deep winters. And it's mostly linked to, or the depressive downward kind of feelings that you end up having, and other things that affect your immune system are usually down to a lack of vitamin D. So you can supplement at the time to make you feel better, but to be honest, vitamin D supplementation did a little bit for me. It definitely got me through the winter months in London, but nothing compared to just being able to get out in the sun. It was something that really affected me when I was spending full winters here in the UK. And it just shows really a lack of resilience for me, not for everyone else. I mean, in the sense that I should have really, you know, I speak to other people with SAD and they're like, yep, but just I've got to like push on through, and winter's going to be over and it's going to come through. That's not me saying that it's not okay to have it. It's me saying I know that I became very uncomfortable to spend time around at the time.
Mm.
But I think it's important to acknowledge that it is a real thing. It's not just someone being mopey. It's not just someone, you know, whinging a bit more in the wintertime. It's like, honour those feelings and be like, okay, I may actually have seasonal affective disorder. Go and seek some advice, whether that is, you know, as simple as trying to increase your time out in the sun, in whatever way that you can, whether it is supplementation of vitamin D. I mean, that's not something that I can just generally blanket recommend to everyone, but definitely those are things that you can do. And if they're very severe depressive thoughts, then again, speaking to a therapist to try and work through those, but also acknowledging that it may be increased, or your feelings are probably more sensitive down to the fact that you may have or be experiencing seasonal affective disorder as well.
Yeah. I suppose as well, if you're somebody who loves being outdoors and active,
mm-hmm.
it's so cold and dark mm-hmm. in the winter months, and so that is going to inhibit you from doing the things that you want to do, so that can make a bigger impact.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think that I'm Australian, and so it's really, we're really lucky. Australians are really lucky and privileged in that sense, because we have had, you know, we have access to, you know, winter months, but they're not winters like this. I really wasn't used to it. I wasn't ready for that kind of experience. And it's just something that you have to think about, I think, around that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. That winter time.
Yeah.
But it's a real thing. So it's not just people kind of whinging about winter. It's like, if you're having really strong, not even strong, if you're feeling down, just know that it may be related to that, and there are things that you can do around the winter months to make it better.
And just on the topic of vitamin D, the NHS actually recommends a vitamin D supplement for everyone.
Amazing. Because so you can blanket statement the
yeah,
vitamin D.
So we can
great.
Actually say everyone should take a vitamin D supplement, because in the UK we are deficient in sunshine. So yes, get on that, especially if you think you might be struggling at this time of year. Thank you for sharing that.
That's all right.
Another thing I wanted to ask you was about something that I think I caught the last half of a talk you were giving, or I think you were on a panel, this is like a year and a bit ago, mm-hmm. and you were talking about something really fascinating to me, heart rate variability.
Yes, I'm so glad you asked about this.
Can you
and
tell?
Not like, what's your favourite outfit to work in or something? Naff like that. I'm like, yes. She's asked me the best questions. HRV, heart rate variability. Okay, so simply, heart rate variability is a measurement of the time or the variation in the time between each heartbeat. And it's controlled by the autonomic nervous system. So I have to give a bit of a breakdown. Is that all right?
Yes, please.
Okay, let's do this. Okay, so stay with me. I'm going to try and keep it as interesting as possible. So autonomic nervous system, okay, which means it's really just automatic. So it's things like your heartbeat, your bladder. Thankfully, it is automatic, because if we had to remember to make our heartbeat, we probably would be dead for a lot of us. Given the amount of things that are on our plate, I definitely wouldn't remember to be like, oh, shit, better squeeze my heart so the blood pumps around my body. So luckily, that's autonomic. Okay. Now, the autonomic nervous system can be kind of broken down into two main branches. Now, I'm sure you know this. I'm just explaining this to everyone. So you've got your parasympathetic nervous system and your sympathetic nervous system. In more simpler terms, your sympathetic nervous system is like your fight or flight. So we often hear about this story about the saber-toothed tiger when talking about the nervous system, and I'll go into that a little bit, but it's your fight or flight mode is like, are you either going to like fight the saber-toothed tiger or are you going to flight, are you going to run away? And then the parasympathetic nervous system is kind of like your rest and digest mode. It's like, actually another friend of mine talks about it as your feed and breed mode. I sometimes say it's like Netflix and chill mode, but it's essentially, it's kind of where all the good shit happens, to be honest. It's where all the rest and then the recovery and the sleep happens. So we want a balance of activity between those two aspects of our nervous system. We obviously need, you know, stress isn't a bad thing. Now, coming back to this saber-toothed tiger, in time, the reason we talk about the saber-toothed tiger is because it's a very primal aspect of our nervous system, right? Our nervous system is primal. It's primitive. And back then, we would have had saber-toothed tigers, right, that we had to watch out for. So if you need to, if a stress like a saber-toothed tiger comes into your life, I promise I'm going to come back to heart rate variability in a second, but you just need to understand this background bit. Okay, saber-toothed tiger comes in and you think, shit, I've either got to run away or I've got to fight it. So there are physiological changes and chemical changes that need to occur within your body to facilitate you to either run away or fight, right? So things like you're being able to breathe at a faster rate, your heart rate moving at a faster rate, pupils dilating, your digestion either, well, it's inhibited, but sometimes it's actually stimulated in the sense that you'll either shit yourself or you'll become really constipated. So I'm team shit yourself. Other people I know under stress are team constipation. I don't know which one's better. I think it's pretty shitty to, excuse the pun, to have to always need to go to the toilet whenever I'm nervous. But that's where the term like nervous poo comes from. Okay. So that's one side of the nervous system. The other side, as I said, is your feed and breed. It's kind of like when you're really chill, when you're able to relax, the body goes, okay, now we can recover. Now we can start to, so digestion's actually increased in the sense, certain parts of the digestive system are increased. So we digest our food better. Various things happen. We facilitate sleep, which is where, you know, a lot of our recovery comes from. We know about sleep deprivation being really detrimental to our health. So back to heart rate variability. Knowing that you have these two aspects, if back in the day where we didn't have such complex stresses in our life, so we didn't have things like, you know, divorce stress and relationship stress and boss stress and deadline stress and all that sort of stuff, we just sort of had like the stresses of, you know, survival versus, you know, just chill. Once the saber-toothed tiger's gone and you've dealt with that situation, you're like, okay, I'm back to parasympathetic nervous system. Life is more complex now. And if we are too imbalanced in the sense that if we spend too much time in that sympathetic state, in that fight or flight mode, so let's say you wake up in the morning, you face traffic, you're late for work, you can already see that your boss is like going to be mad at you. You can actually put yourself in a sympathetic state without an actual stressful situation being there. So we as humans are capable of doing all these physiological changes and chemical changes that in excess are really dangerous just by imagining what your boss will say if you do a shit job, you know what I mean? And or fighting with your partner in your mind or whatever it might be. So with this imbalance comes a reduction in your heart rate variability. So a low heart rate variability is linked to things like depression, anxiety. It's also linked to cardiovascular disease. It's also linked to just a shorter lifespan. So what we want to see with heart rate variability is a high variability. So people often get it confused because we think that actually when we take our heart rate, we want to see a low heart rate, right? We want to see a low pulse. That's true for fitness. But heart rate variability, we want it to be high because what it shows and what it's indicative of is how well your system can shift gears between your sympathetic and your parasympathetic states, so between that fight or flight mode and then back to chill. So we want a high HRV. And the way that we can measure this is like waking up in the morning and taking our heart rate and seeing what the state of our nervous system is. Now, the reason this information is important, not just from a sort of like, you know, vague health perspective, is actually also because it does determine how you should probably do a workout for that day. So I feel like it's sort of phasing out a little bit, but there's a huge push towards, this is why I come back to this fitness punishment kind of mentality, is that people often think like, oh, if I'm not working really, really hard all the time, then it's going to be really bad for me, you know, and I'm not achieving my fitness goals. But we have to acknowledge the state. Now, I'm not just talking about your mental state as in like, yeah, I feel fine. I'm ready to get fit. It's like, no, how are you really? Like, going back to your question, how are you really? Are you stressed out of your fucking mind, but you've been really good at ignoring it mentally, but your body is like, I have a low HRV, my hair's falling out, and blah, 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 all these different reasons, right? Or these physiological signs. So HRV can be some data that you can check in the morning that gives you a good indication of like, should I go to that HIIT class at lunchtime? Or actually, would I be better off going to the meditation class that I keep avoiding? You know, or would I be better off just actually resting today and going for a walk out in nature? And HRV is just a tiny, easy, non-invasive bit of data that you can collect every day. There's an app called Elite HRV. That's the one that I use, but there's plenty out there. And it just collects that data over time. And you really need to collect it for, at least a month to gauge where your nervous system is at and how you should start to then go, maybe I should be chilling out on the workouts a little bit. You know, because another thing, and I should have mentioned this, is that we have to remember that fitness and exercise is a form of stress on the body. Now, if you're in a relaxed state, that stress is necessary because stress is what induces adaptation. And adaptation is just another word for the changes that occur, which is what we know as, in our minds, results, hashtag results, right? Or hashtag gains. So if we want those changes to really occur, so all the work we're putting into our fitness and our exercise, if we want those changes to occur, we need to be able to shift between that sympathetic state back to the parasympathetic state. And if you're not doing that, then you're inhibiting your results. So your workouts are in vain and they're just stressing you out further. So that was a very long, long-winded way of explaining. I told you this would happen.
Fascinating. That is totally, a penny has just dropped now for me, and I understand that. And a lot of people that I speak to don't really understand even things about the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system. To have you explain that, I think, is really helpful.
Okay, good.
And obviously a lot of people listening with anxiety are very much in their sympathetic mode a lot of the time. I've heard it also described as tend and befriend mode.
Oh,
have you heard of that one?
I like that.
Well, it kind of sounds cute, but it's about people pleasing and looking after people because you're so stressed
sympathetic has been named. Shit. See, I'm so codependent that of course I'm like, yes, people pleasing. That's my middle name. Yeah, fuck.
Tend and befriend sounds really cute, but actually, if we're scared,
that's interesting.
Then we might be more likely to carry out those behaviours.
Yeah.
So what is your opinion? So for a lot of people that I speak to, they say, my spin class sorts me out when I'm feeling really anxious. I go and it really calms me down. Mm-hmm. Is that maybe not having a great effect on the body then, if someone is really anxious to go and do that?
Yeah, and this is why heart rate, yes, possibly. I think it's hard to again give a blanket answer, but something like HRV cuts out this sort of psychological interpretation that you might be making around yourself. So like if you're in a really anxious state but you've been living like that for the last 10 years and anxiety is your baseline, and then you don't know what actually that's doing to your body. Getting data like that is very incredibly beneficial because you can't lie to yourself. It's just pure data. And then you can kind of make honest changes. Perhaps the spin class is great for that person. Perhaps anxiety is you know, the term anxiety, while it's a very real thing, and it really is, particularly if it's an anxiety disorder, is a really real thing and has real physiological effects, damaging effects long term, and even short term. I think that one of the reasons that things like this are so complicated is because it is down to the individual's psychology. And so some people handle the same environmental or situational stress differently to others, right? We know this, which is why it can be easy for some people to be like, I'm not stressed. I'm fine. They don't even know that they're anxious, but their body is giving off these signs. So for those that are addicted to things like high intensity interval training or just training in general, right, whether it's a spin class or what it might be, I would just urge you to start collecting that data. You don't need to stop your spin class yet. Just start collecting that data and see what it says. And then you can be really honest with yourself. Do I have an exercise addiction? Do I have an addiction to this adrenal state where I'm like trying to actually use exercise to ignore underlying issues? Or is it still good for me and it's fine and I'm not, I feel great and it's fine and my body isn't struggling and my HRV is very high. I have high HRV. Just remember that because it gets confusing. People are like, no, I want a low heart rate, low heart rate variability. No, we want a low heart rate, higher heart rate variability. Yeah?
Good.
Yes.
Good. So good to remember that.
Good to remember.
I've completely forgotten what I was going to say.
Sorry.
But I really want to remember. What was it? So there are people who could be very anxious or stressed but not really realise it. And maybe they are really snappy with their partner or they suddenly are not sleeping well and go to lots of spin classes. So
I love the spin. Are we talking about you?
No, I find spin stressful. That's
yeah,
why.
So do
it's
I.
Basically projecting my own hatred of spin classes.
No, I get it. I hate it. One of the reasons I'm just chiming in here, but one of the reasons I hate spin is because what I see is a lot of office workers, people that work behind a desk, will go to spin. And from a postural perspective, you're essentially going from one chair to another chair. So your hips are in a flexed position and they go to another flexed position. And the reason that that's problematic is that if you're only doing spin as your only form of exercise, or it's your main form of exercise, it's an imbalance in the strength, muscular strength in your body, or just movement imbalance. Yeah, there's so much flexion, like forward flexion over a desk and then moving over a bike. So it's not, to me, it's not an ideal way. If you love spin and you love it on your lunch break because mentally it does make you feel better, then do it. But then just make sure you're also doing other stuff that is counteracting so much of that forward flexion. Yeah, sorry. So back to your question, what were you going to say?
I think it was more a statement of just for people to be on the lookout for those signs that they might be stressed, more stressed or anxious than they realise, the physical signs that the body shows us, or, yeah, looking into their HRV, seeing what that's saying, because we don't always know, because sometimes we can get so used to feeling anxious all the time that it becomes totally normal. And I often hear people say, what, does everyone not lie awake at night on a Sunday evening worrying about the week ahead? I thought that was, everyone did that.
Exactly.
Like, no, not everyone.
And our capitalist society has really driven us towards glorifying this notion of busy and this notion of like high stress, resilience to that sort of thing. And I think that lasts probably, we can get through it for 10 years, but then the body starts to break down. And then we wonder why, our hair's falling out or, we're seeing different physiological signs that we hate. And the worst part is that then we're sold some form of anti-aging cream or some form of like hair replacement. And it's like, why don't you just take care of it before it starts to fail on you? So yeah, exactly. It's like, the model our society sets us up in benefits from us being stressed out and dying. Sorry, that's really dark.
No, that's such it's a big topic. Talk about how capitalism affects us and our mental health. I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this question, but you mentioned it before we started recording.
Go.
Can we talk about attachment theory? We're getting very like into...
I'm not quite a qualified psychologist yet, but we absolutely can talk about attachment theory.
Because you are going to finish your training.
Yes. I'm at the very early stages of a psychology degree. But yes, that is what I'm going into. Attachment theory was something that I became interested in after reading a good friend of mine, Laura Mooker, who's written a book called Love Factually. And she unpacks essentially through both interviewing experts on it, but also interviewing people from different categories of attachment theory. I feel like I'm terrible at explaining it in a really simple way. So I don't know whether you want to have, you might want to cut this bit out because I still haven't found a very simple way to define attachment theory. But it's very, very interesting when you start looking into it. There's two sort of, it's kind of broken down between insecure attachment styles and secure attachment styles. And I think the facts that Laura Mooker had put in her book was something around, I can't remember where she'd taken this from, but correct me if I'm wrong, is around 20% of the population will have an insecure attachment. Might be more, might be 40%. So my memory is failing me. But insecure attached people can be broken down into three categories: avoidant attached, anxious attached, and then one that's called disorganized, which is kind of a mix between the two and usually indicative of people that had like really severe trauma. So they kind of go in childhood, so they go between being avoidant or expressing avoidant aspects and anxious aspects. Anxious and avoidant people tend to have the same fundamental belief. Something in their childhood or earlier childhood or sometimes even later childhood or some trauma in their life has caused them to believe fundamentally that they are unworthy of love. And it expresses in different ways. So an anxious attached person tends to be that person that we coin as being really like needy and is always needing reassurance that they're loved and might play a lot of games in the relationship to try and prove that they're loved and might get very jealous very easily, things like that. An avoidant attachment style is what is kind of glorified in Hollywood, particularly with men, is this behavior of like the bad boy that's kind of like, you know, moody and always pushing their lovers away and might express, you know, will sometimes love bomb right at the beginning of the relationship really intensely, and then suddenly the next day you wake up and they're like, they've disappeared on you as soon as they have to be vulnerable or intimate.
Chloe's smiling at me like, yeah, know that one.
And so securely attached people don't really tend to express these sort of things. So it's a very, very deep and amazing topic and something that I think just anyone that's experienced really kind of, I guess, like shocking relationship experiences, I would highly recommend reading attachment theory. And I've had so many people write to me since I've started talking about it on social media, reaching out saying, oh my God, I read Love Factually and it just totally explained me. There's another book called Attached, which explains attachment theory in a really beautiful and profound way as well. And makes it less taboo as well, because I think sometimes if you are insecurely attached, if you do express these behaviors that seem kind of dysfunctional, it makes you feel a lot of shame about yourself. And for a long time, I was like, oh my God, I feel so ashamed that I'm that person or that I can just be described in these like 10 sentences of behavior. But in actual fact, there are benefits to those behaviors and to why you behaved in that way at that time and why you developed those characteristics, because they served you at a time when you were experiencing trauma in your life. And so it's not worth actually hating on yourself if you are avoidant or anxious or have any of those sorts of behaviors. It's just about understanding them and noticing the triggers and being able to express and communicate so that you can start to calm those triggers down. So I highly recommend people look into those.
That's
for sure.
Such a great explanation. Yeah. Just talking from my own experience, I'm pretty sure I was anxious attached.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Like things like being left to cry as a baby, that was very trendy when I was born. And my parents did it in quite a I don't know, I think my mum, you know, her mental health wasn't great because she couldn't sleep. And so she left me to cry so she could sleep. And I totally understand. And it's a very, you know, complicated topic, but I'm pretty sure that led to me thinking I'm not lovable. Mm-hmm. And then my boyfriend probably got the brunt of that. We've been together 10 years now. And the first few years, our relationship was a real nightmare.
Tumultuous. And would you say that he's more securely attached?
He's very secure.
Beautiful.
He's one of these very secure people.
Beautiful.
So, yes, that helped
boyfriend.
Me a lot. And having therapy for those kind of insecurities and making that a real mission to overcome that. But yeah, I love what you said about not having shame about it, you know.
Really important.
It's not anyone's fault what happens to you when you're a child. And it's not even our parents' fault. Mm-hmm. You know, they are responsible, but they're not to blame. So I think just having compassion for all parties whenever you're working through.
It's difficult. And it comes, you know, it's hard. It depends on the severity of the experience you had growing up. But like working towards forgiveness towards anyone, whether it's your partner or your parents, is not necessarily about liberating them, but actually liberating you, because it's holding on to the resentment that causes the pain, whether it be in the relationship or parental relationship or any relationships that we have. Easier said than done. So, you know, that's the journey. And that's why therapy, again, is so important, because we all have those things. It's not about being crazy. It's just about having experiences in your life that have shaped the way you behave. And it's not necessarily taboo. It's just saying, okay, let's unpack that a little bit. Let's try and get to the bottom of it. Because ultimately it just harms you, right? Like all of the anxious attachment behaviors, they probably helped you at the time to gain what you perceive to be love from your parents. But in real life, in adult life, it's not that beneficial or helpful.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make it easy to just change one day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we take on board that programming that exactly helped us at the time. And it just stays like a very out-of-date computer program that's running in the background, like sabotaging our relationships.
Exactly. You need to do an update. And unfortunately, it takes longer than an overnight kind of like plug the phone in and do an overnight update, if only. God, imagine. How good would that be? Just plug something in.
But it's the future. Download.
Yeah.
Good mental
Download,
health.
Upgrade mental health. No pain. Good.
Thank you for that. I kind of wanted to ask you about social media, because it's such a big part. Well, I don't know. Is it a big part of your life? It seems like it is. But how do you manage that? Has it affected you negatively in the past or now? Mm. Do you have boundaries around social media?
Yes. So, yes, absolutely. I definitely have had to implement some pretty strong boundaries around social media. In fact, I even just downloaded an app recently because I was going to test it out, particularly when I started uni. What's it called? Actually, I wonder if it's downloaded on this phone. It might be on my Australian phone, but let me just check. I'm going to scroll right to the end. Okay, cool. No, it hasn't downloaded this one. Great. But it's basically an app that locks you out of certain apps that you want to for certain periods of time. Yes, right,
this.
Right. So, isn't it so funny that I get the same reaction for everyone I tell them about it. Like, whoa. So once you've set it, you can't turn it off. Like as in once it blocks you out, you can't turn it off. You can change the settings, obviously, but once it comes on. And I just feel like that would be really beneficial for university, because it's now become a very subconscious programming to open up the app. Like, I don't know if anyone else can relate to this. You probably can relate to this in that sometimes when I do something with my phone, once I finish doing it, let's say I've got something in the email app and I finish writing an email, whatever, before I close my phone down, because I don't need to do anything else, I will open Instagram. I'll check it again, even if I didn't mean to. Even if I literally just went on there to check my calendar, I will close the app and open up Instagram. And I think that definitely got to a point where I was like, this is problematic, because I'm losing control over my behavior. And the experience that I've had in watching others with addiction, that's the exact same thing. So, acknowledgement and I think being honest with yourself about addictions is really the first key to healing them. And I wouldn't necessarily suggest that I am no, do you know what? I'm just going to say it. I think that I am definitely addicted to social media because there is a real strong behavioral draw to opening it and interacting with it. And I can say it's got to do with my work, which it does, but when it becomes your work, it's very difficult to draw the line between, well, what is really work? What are you really getting done? So I had to spend some time recently just saying, okay, like how, when I'm opening this app, like how much of it am I really doing productive work that's going to lead to, you know, an actual result, and how much of it is just me getting that dopamine hit from pulling down the thing, scrolling, checking, things like that. So you have to be very honest with yourself. And for me, I just realized, like, do you know what? I'd like to have designated times where I write back to my DMs and I write back to people asking questions about the program or fitness or health or things that I genuinely enjoy doing. And then as soon as I've finished, no scrolling. There's nothing that I'm going to get there that I can't get from actually reading an article or, you know, interacting with something really beneficial and educational for me, particularly with uni coming up. So those are the boundaries that I've had to set now. It's like designated time periods. In terms of affecting my mental health, I think that it's definitely, there's definitely been times, particularly for someone who is more on the codependent side, where it's like I feel like a real people pleaser, that I found it difficult to manage everyone's expectations, which has caused me to get stuck in a little bit of a loop where I almost post nothing because I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to do this and offend this person or do this and affect that person. And if I talk about food in this way, it might cause an eating disorder. But if I don't talk about it, then the people that are wanting that information aren't getting it. And so I'm just like, oh shit, I'll just, here's a picture of me doing some yoga. You know, it's like, what's the most neutral thing I can post? And the problem with that is that we're not getting an honest portrayal or any kind of information or integrity there because it's just someone being too scared to post anything. So I think cancel culture has really influenced a lot of the way that people are presenting information, particularly the bigger your profile becomes, the harder it is to mitigate the effects of cancel culture. But I was having this conversation with my manager this morning and I just thought, you know what? My heart of hearts, I know that I have no bad intentions and I have no intentions that are going to be detrimental to people. So I just have to keep putting the information out there and acknowledge that people will do what they will with certain types of information. And there's just only so much responsibility that you can take. You can only take it so far. I do take my responsibility very, very, very important or very seriously, I would say, on Instagram. But, you know, for example, I can't, if I post a workout and say this is a great workout for, I cannot, there's no way that I can accommodate for someone with a spine injury, for someone with a knee injury, for someone, you just can't do it. So what do you do? Do you not post anything because it's too dangerous? Someone with a spine injury that decides to deny their spine injury goes on there and does it and you're responsible for that? Or do you have to put a disclaimer every time? Do you have to acknowledge like that person and say, P.S., if you have this, this and this, you shouldn't be doing this? I mean, it's difficult to navigate.
Totally, because there's only so much text and only so much space that you can write stuff in. So yeah, it's impossible to account for everything. And I suppose it's just a numbers game. The more followers you have, the more potential there is that someone's going to get upset or offended or
exactly
whatever.
Exactly.
So it is tricky.
It is tricky. How do you navigate it?
Up until recently, well, I noticed I posted something in maybe December or November that, on reflection, on reading it back more carefully, I was like, I actually don't 100% agree with that.
Interesting.
So I posted something that was like, anxiety can be unlearned. And I think it said something like, no one is born with anxiety. So I maybe just didn't think enough. It was one of these kind of memes that goes around that I just thought, oh, this is a nice thing. It said some other things as well that I did agree with. I didn't give it enough thought.
Right.
And there were people who felt invalidated.
Their anxiety was invalidated.
The fact that they had anxiety and there is a genetic component, which
yes,
is a fact. And it made me really reflect and have to realize I need to be more careful about what I'm posting because a kind of a pithy, you know, two sentence meme image could cause harm or could, you know, yeah, really invalidate people. So I realize I need to be more careful, especially
yes,
as my people that follow me is going up. But yeah, I mean, it's impossible to be completely perfect.
I have
this thing of wanting to be perfect, but it's impossible.
It's really difficult. And then the other thing is that I have to say, and this is my bone to pick with, you know, the rest of society, is that we're also very hungry for black and white statements. You know, we're addicted to those.
Mm.
So, you know, we want them because ultimately, you know, grey is not only boring, but it's unsafe. Like, a grey area is unsafe. It makes us feel like we can't control the situation. If we know something is black and white, we feel more in control. So what irritates me is that we'll gravitate towards media headlines and headlines in general that are black and white because it's like, oh, feel safe. No carbs after 4 p.m. By the way, that's total BS, but I'm just using that as an example, right? And so people are like, oh, okay. Or carbs are bad or whatever. And something ridiculous like that is like makes us feel safe because we can move in that direction. We go, okay, tick. I know to either do or don't do this. So while we feel frustrated and invalidated by a statement that you've made in that sense, it can also be frustrating because people will tend to gravitate more towards those people in the media that are making black and white statements and therefore increasing their platform, you know, which is that problematic? I don't know. Should we be working towards like polarizing our audience so that the audience that we do have are really strong and really like focused and engaged? Or are we trying to cater to everyone and then not actually saying anything at all? I mean, what's the
so
answer?
Interesting. I've actually thought about that a lot recently about, you know, should I be more outrageous in order to get more followers or something? But
well,
I don't think that's my role.
No, you definitely don't want to lose your integrity in order to get more followers. But there's an element of like, how do you play the game of not so much to get more followers, but to just be to be a stronger voice in our society? Because yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. I'm still battling that. I'm like, do I become a bit more aggressive and have a stronger opinion? But I'm sort of like, well, that isn't me because I do have compassion for those that don't fit into those boxes, you know, or for someone that doesn't accommodate for or accommodate to. So it's like, for now, I'm just going to have long-ass captions with disclaimers that are like, P.S., if you are this, don't do this. If you are that, don't do that, you know?
Yeah, doing things with more care and being okay with the grey areas. And things are complex.
Things are complex.
We don't have a... There isn't a one-size-fits-all for fitness, for mental health.
No.
There are statements that are not going to apply to everyone, and we need to acknowledge that, I think.
Absolutely. Because also your the post that you made probably would have helped a lot of people.
I mean, it got more likes than
well, exactly. So it would have been very. It would have been enough to capture the attention of so many. So I think it's a really fine line because it's like if it captured the attention of a lot of people and actually helped them rather than invalidated them and only invalidated a few. It's like, what's better, helping thousands hurting? Oh, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I'm like,
we need like an ethics of social media.
Yeah. And it's so new. It's so new.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really, really new thing. And it's a really interesting social experiment that hopefully is not going to be detrimental, but might be a little bit.
I think it, already is in lots of ways. But I wanted to ask you about Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a Brazilian. I was like, all right, we're going
switching.
Well, yeah, hair removal. That's
switching
an interesting
topics.
Topic. Yeah. Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Yes. Martial arts.
I want to try this.
Yes.
I've seen a lot of things about this. I heard it's like wrestling.
It is. It's grappling.
Yes.
It's a grappling martial arts.
Yeah.
I like to say that it's like chess with the body. Because, you know, martial arts is... it's physical, right? So it is a great form of exercise, but the added element of being with an opponent means that you have to try and calculate steps ahead before you make a move. And that is, it's a workout for my brain as much as it is a workout for my body. And I just find it so incredibly empowering. There's no striking, so that's beneficial for me. Because to be honest, it doesn't really matter if I have a black eye and have to do some video content for it. I did actually have a black eye not so long ago from jiu-jitsu randomly because one of the girls I was grappling with had dropped her head in on my cheekbone and it just went completely brown. But that doesn't happen that often. For the most part, it's known as like the gentle art. It's not really gentle, but for a martial art, it should be. It should be closest to that. The highest level of martial art is really to be able to win without hurting the other. And I find that such a profound statement philosophically as well. But that's a whole other conversation. For me, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu has changed my life in so many ways. On the surface level, it's made it so that I find exercise incredibly boring. I have to tell you, like, ooh, truth be told, you know, lifting like a weight 10 times in the same way, in the same plane for different body parts I find it really boring. I do it because it supports my ability to do other things in life. And that's my whole approach to fitness, is essentially fitness isn't life. P.S. Okay, not for me anyway. But fitness and exercise and paying attention to nutrition is really directed towards enabling me to be able to do the things with my body that I would like to do for long periods of time. So I love snowboarding. I love jiu-jitsu. I love surfing. I love to skate. I like to hike. I like all of these things that are very, very dependent upon my body being in strong and fit and healthy. So that's what that's why I exercise. That's why I lift a weight in the same plane of motion 10 times. That is why I, you know, work towards doing those sorts of things. Now, other people get more joy from being able to do, you know, certain things in the weights room. And that is, that's awesome. It's just not, that's not my bag. That's not where my background's in gymnastics. So it's like been such complex, fun, interactive movements. So to go back to doing weights training is just having to rewire my brain and rewire what I like. So what was the question? Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So for me, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu has shaped the way that I train in a different way. It gives me a more interesting reason to lift weights. It's like, all right, well, I need to do these pull-ups because if I don't have that level of strength in my grip, in my back, then I'm going to be not as good in Jiu-Jitsu, or I'm not going to have the stamina and the strength that's required to do this. So for me, it's given me a whole other kind of inspiration and motivation to train outside of the jiu-jitsu space, which is really beneficial, particularly for anyone out there that's like really struggling with motivation. I hear you. I get you. You need to find something that is potentially like a sport that might make you go, okay, I love playing football, but if I want to play football well, even if it is just like playing with your workmates or whatever, then I probably do need to do a bit more running, or probably do need to strengthen my glutes, probably do need to make sure that my knees are in good condition. So I think Jiu-Jitsu for me has given me extra motivation in other areas of my life that benefit my health. The other thing I like about it is I feel more empowered as a woman. Sometimes I hate saying the word empowered because it denotes that we didn't have power in the first place and that we needed to have power. So I don't like to use that word too much. But I also think that from a protective space, feeling strong and safe and capable of protecting myself, definitely, like before jiu-jitsu, I would have felt less safe than I do now, knowing a little bit of self-defense. And it's amazing how much that can psychologically influence other aspects of your life, particularly if you're a people pleaser, if you're codependent in any sort of way. The subconscious effects that even just knowing you can physically protect yourself make your interactions with human beings a lot different. You feel less inclined to have to say yes or to say no, or whatever it might be, whatever you are doing, whatever behavior you're eliciting in a way of like people pleasing. It changes that really, really. And I speak to all the people pleasers out there in that it's just made me feel like more empowered to say no. I don't know. I can't explain it.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
There is such a link between our physicality and how confident we feel in the world. And for a lot of people listening, I'm sure people pleasing resonates.
Yeah.
So maybe get yourself down to some
Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, martial arts. Another thing is that for me, I find it very difficult, again, as a people pleaser, to express anger. And it's a very natural human emotion. But if you oppress anger, this is where things like depression can come from. Mm. When we oppress and suppress, it leads to depression. And so if you spend too long oppressing things like that, it can surface in other areas of your behavior. So Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for me was a very controlled way to express aggression that isn't that is important to allow to come up, but isn't going to necessarily hurt someone else. Because with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, your objective isn't to hurt them. It's just to put them in a position that causes them to submit. So you tap, you double tap someone wherever on the body part that you can reach, or you yell out or whatever, before they hurt you. So there are various positions where you might be in a position where if they pulled any harder, your elbow would break or you would choke them or whatever. And so the objective is when you get them into a submission, then you tap and that person releases you. So there's never, whereas with a striking martial art, I mean, you get hit in the face, you're not going to tap before you get hit in the face. You know what I mean? There's no protection there. So that's why it's called, one of the reasons it's called the gentle art. But why was I telling you that? Yes, I think innately as human beings, we all have primal aggression that needs releasing. And I think it needs to be released in a physical way as much as it needs to be, you know, can be released in your career or your relationships in various ways. I think it's very, very important to release it on a physical level as well.
Totally. Yeah, I was telling a client recently to pound on the sofa or on the bed with your forearms to release some anger and to make noise and shout and scream and kind of wiggle your body around as you're doing it to move the energy of that anger so that you're not suppressing it and keeping it inside your body, which is like a heavy weight to carry with you.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for everything you share. This has been a really varied conversation and I've loved the sciencey bits. Can you share a bit more about if people want to learn about your online courses, your the things that you offer?
Sure.
Tell us
about
that.
So I have a thing called the Virtue Method, which is, as I explained earlier, focusing on strength, fitness and mobility. And so you can find all of it either on my website, which is just www.shonavirtue.com. And it has all the information there. And that's where the programs sit as well. They're 12-week online video-based programs. And they're all in real time. So I think one of the things that I always wanted to create were online programs where we work out together for the full period of time rather than just kind of like a moving GIF that's like, lift this, push that, do this. It's like, I'm with you there the whole time.
You're sweating along with us.
Exactly. Sweating and swearing, I always say. And you're probably swearing at me and that's okay because I can't hear you. And so that's probably the best place to find me. Instagram, Shona_Virtue. You can stalk me for a bit and see what I'm all about. But make sure you spell Virtue with an E, V-E-R-T-U-E. Yes.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope that you gained a lot from this episode. Come on over to Instagram and let me know, what are you taking from this episode? Find me at Chloe Brotheridge. And I would love it if you would leave me a review in the podcast app or in iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, leave me a rating. And is there someone in your life that would really benefit from this podcast? You can let them know by sharing this podcast. I'd be so, so grateful. So I'm just wishing you a wonderful week ahead, sending you loads of love. Hopefully you'll tune in again and I'll see you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.